Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Hi, I'm Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community. I'm listening to you sing, Alan. We'll be speaking with Alan Phillips, attorney at law. Today is January 26th. 2012. We want to wish everyone in India Happy Republic Day. They signed their independence laws and they are celebrating. I think they might have off from school or off from work, but it's a big day for them over there. And if you are available, come and listen to these educational, free, informative broadcasts on Blog Talk Radio, Homeopathy World Community. Share these great shows with your friends on Twitter, on Facebook, Dig, StumbleUpon, Reddit, MySpace. You can do a lot to get the word out and learn, help others learn about these important issues for maintaining your health and maintaining your freedoms and rights. You can put the embed code for each of the shows onto your website, onto your blog. You can favorite the show, become a regular listener. Comment on the live chat, even call in to the call-in number and get a reminder button. There's a lot of things that you can do. So today we are going to do a roundup of lots of events that are happening in terms of vaccinations and your rights. Also, you would want to visit Alan's website, pandemicresponseproject.com. He has lots of information there that you can peruse and learn. He also has an e-guide for vaccination exemptions and waivers. Once you learn about all this stuff, you're going to want to take, say, whoa, I'm not putting that in my body. And stuff is going in your body whether you like it or not in some places in the world. So here we go. Alan.
Good afternoon, Debbie. Pleasure to be here with you, as always. There is... with every show that we do, there's more that has gone on in the news relating to vaccines and our health freedom rights in the last weeks than we have time to go into in any detail. Today we're going to cover just lightly several different topics because there's just an enormous number of important developments ongoing just in the last few days. All of the information we're talking about today comes from articles posted on the news page of the Pandemic Response Project. As you said, it's pandemicresponseproject.com. First article here comes from Alex Jones's Infowars.com website. And it's a story about a doctor who reportedly called police and child services on a mother who refused to vaccinate her son. When the doctor became aware of that at a medical visit, the mother had taken the child to a doctor, a 2.5-year-old. I try generally not to dive into details of news reports concerning individual parental disputes with officials because it's really difficult when you get information off the internet to really know whether or not you're getting a full or complete story. There's almost always more than one side of that. But what I wanted to do is comment more generally about this type of scenario because it's one that does happen and certainly can happen that many doctors just really take it personally when a patient, pediatricians in particular, when a parent says, we don't vaccinate. And there are any number of different possible reactions that doctors have. But we need to understand that doctors, as a starting place, doctors and other professionals are often required by law to report any suspected child negligence or child abuse to Child Protective Services or local departments of social services. And so it's not always just a case of a medical doctor being vindictive or so aggressively pro-vaccine that they feel this personal moral obligation to turn in parents who aren't vaccinating. So with regard to these issues generally, I think as a starting point, it's important for parents or anyone for that matter to understand kind of a simple but often overlooked or misunderstood legal framework that all of this sits in. And it boils down the first layer of the analysis, at least, if you will, boils down to there are only three places legally that one can be with regard to vaccines, and in particular mandatory vaccines. And that is you are either doing the vaccines, or in the case of parents, having your kids vaccinated, or you are exercising an available legal exemption option. The particular options available depend on the particular context and applicable law that varies from state to state or context to context. Or you're doing none of those first two. You're neither immunizing yourself or your children, and you are also not exercising an exemption. It's people in that third category that are legally vulnerable to some sort of action being taken against them. So if you're a parent who has concerns about vaccines and you say, just a sort of a personal decision, I'm not going to vaccinate my kids until I look into this further. I was once such a parent myself, and before I went to law school and understood the law, and I at that time, like many other parents, I'm sure before and since, wandered unwittingly into a legal gray area. If you're not either doing the vaccines that are mandated, if you're not either doing the vaccines or exercising an exemption, you're probably not in compliance with the law. And those are the people that legally are vulnerable to being accused of medically neglecting their children or potentially abusing their children. These specific definitions for neglect and abuse are going to vary from state to state, but you're at risk in that third category. So the really important takeaway from this article and this topic generally is, I mean, yes, of course, do your research, decide whether or not you want to vaccinate yourself or your children, but understand that if there's a law mandating vaccines, that unless you are properly exercising an exemption that's available to you in your state or your situation, you may not be in compliance with the law, and you may be vulnerable.
Can you just mention in the case of this arrest for the mother who refused to vaccinate, was she in compliance at all? Did she have a legal waiver or an exemption, or did she just not vaccinate?
Well, it's unclear from the information in the article, and this is why I started, an example at least of why
right.
I started. I said it's really hard to analyze facts about family law matters generally, and in particular family law matters, because the people who write the articles will often be approaching the subject from a particular slant or position, may or may not have all the relevant information for a proper and complete legal analysis. Now, I'm not suggesting that the writer of this article did anything inappropriate, certainly not in any deliberate way or whatever. He or she set out with a particular reporting agenda and goal and accomplished that very well, and we should all be very concerned about this kind of issue. In the way that this was reported. So it's not a criticism of the writer, but it's just sort of a general condition.
She was put in a corner by the pediatrician who had to fulfill his legal obligations.
Well, it's not clear whether, because of the information here doesn't make it clear whether or not the pediatrician was responding out of a legal obligation or a personal vendetta or some combination of the two. It's also not clear whether the mother was exercising an exemption, although the implication is that she wasn't, because based on the information presented, it says that she just said, no, we're not going to vaccinate.
Yeah.
But it's also not clear whether or not she would qualify for an exemption. This is in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania
right.
has medical and religious exemptions, but the religious exemption law is worded in a fairly broad way. It says something to the effect of, if you have religious objections or sincere moral convictions similar in character to that of a religious belief. I've seen similar kinds of languages in other laws.
I think Pennsylvania is a very difficult place to get away with not vaccinating, as far as I know from friends who live there. And also in the article, it mentions the brand new American Academy of Pediatrics vaccination form. And that also has wording that she felt put her at risk.
Yeah, that's a separate issue. We can maybe come back to that at a future time and expound on that in depth. But I've got an article at the vaccinerights.com website that goes in depth about that. That raises serious ethical and even legal issues, the use of that form.
That's probably, you know, she was really put into a tight position, and that's why she stood her ground, and then it probably escalated, I can imagine. But
Here's the fundamental flaw. Based on the information given, this woman made a fundamental flaw, and the fundamental, or may have, and the fundamental flaw was she asserted a position that may not have been legally viable.
Right.
It may
right.
have made perfect sense, especially to those of us in the alternative vaccine community who believe that we should have a fundamental right to refuse vaccines without having to justify it at all. The problem is, in Virginia, you don't have a right to do that with regard to mandatory vaccines, and that's probably why, where, and how she ran into problems.
Right, I think it was Pennsylvania. But that is true. And I'm thinking, as I hear you and read a little bit more about it, that if I were a parent put in such and such a position, I might say to the physician, at this visit, I am going to pass having the vaccine for my child right now. I will set a date for a new appointment and talk to you about it further, instead of having to deal with the issue on the spot without legal representation and someone supporting me. I would rather put it off to the next time and not be outright, you know, in that way.
Well, that's not going to necessarily help you, though, because the point is that if the doctor believes that your position is...
I'm not stating my position. I'm saying...
Well, by saying you're not vaccinating right now, you are saying, in effect, to the doctor that I choose to be irresponsible. Well, from the doctor's point of view. In other words, the bottom line here is that it's a legal question. You know, if you are not complying with the law to get vaccines that are required... Then you must either be exercising an exemption or you are not in compliance with the law. And so the proper thing to say there, if you can, is we are exercising a legal exemption, and so won't be getting the vaccines today.
I see.
And it's unfortunate that we are limited to that frame of reference, but that's the starting place. If we don't like that limited option, then our responsibility as citizens is to become legislatively active to get laws enacted that allow us greater freedom. So the short-term solution is you better be exercising an exemption if you're not getting your children mandatory vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
And the long-term solution is we better become legislatively active in order to create the rights that most of us in this on this side of the issue feel are fundamental rights that we should have, but it turns out that we don't. You know, I see over and over again, and we'll talk about it if we get to it in today's show, in one of the other articles, and I see this over and over again. People say, well, I have a you know, a constitutional right to decide what goes into my body. Well, it turns out that in America at this point in time, no, you don't. I see people, including attorneys, make the assertion, well, we have a constitutional right to a religious exemption to vaccines. Well, no, the current state of the law is we don't have that right. And the reason it's important to understand, because courts have ruled on that issue now, it's important to understand where we are legally, whether we like it or not, is a separate question. And if we don't like it, then we need to take steps to fix it. So we could ask our state or federal legislators to enact laws giving us a right, whether the Constitution requires it or not. And we could, at least hypothetically, strive to include medical freedom, to amend the Constitution to include medical freedom or other language that would give us a constitutional right to refuse any medical treatment if we don't want it for ourselves or our children, on religious or non-religious grounds for that matter. Now, you know, those are very tall orders in the real world to achieve, but if we don't understand the current state of the law, the starting place, then we can't fix it.
Right. Well, that's why we're having this show, and that's why I'm listening to you. So I know what to say to my doctor, or I know what, or I know what I need to tell my children to say to their doctor for the for my grandchildren. So let's move to the next issue because we have so many to go.
Sure.
The damage,
sure.
Children damaged by GSK swine flu vaccine. They demand compensation for permanent harm. And this is dealing with the issue of the narcolepsy patients.
Narcolepsy patients in this particular article in Finland, although there have been several countries that reported narcolepsy as a side effect of the swine flu vaccine. But I've seen a series of articles over many months from this same Finnish publication, and they have an English version of the publication. Bless them. This is an issue that's been evolving over time. So it started with claims of at least correlation of jumps in narcolepsy rates in children who had received the swine flu vaccine. And after a period of many months, I don't know, maybe it was a year and a half or so, I think, before I finally saw an article that said they had determined that it was, in fact, something caused by the swine flu vaccines. Good for Finland for being able to own up to that. Good for Finland for agreeing to compensate narcolepsy patients. And now this most recent article is going more directly to the issue of what is fair compensation. And what we have is a group of lawyers that say the impairments sustained by 45 of their patient clients have been found to be permanent, but the compensation is being based on a less severe ground. You know, narcolepsy, as we've talked about in past shows, has to do with sort of random and spontaneous falling asleep, and it's not hard for any layperson to imagine that that's a sort of condition that could
impact their life. Yeah.
Well, ruin
it's sort
your
of
professional
like,
and personal life.
It's like, you know, if you were an epileptic and had seizures and they were going to come on at any time, and if there was no medication available to control that, then you couldn't drive. You were you know, in the middle of some sort of a conversation and blank out. I mean, these are things that affect your everyday life and your ability to function and carry on a job at a position and, your, as you said, your relationships. So, yes, it is a very severe deteriorating disease.
So, apparently, there has been, and it looks like the compensation for temporary harm, which is where the government is starting in this case, they're not really arguing about that. The temporary harm, which they're putting under a, mainly under a pain and suffering category, includes advanced payouts in euros ranging from 8,700 to 20,000 euros. That's roughly 11,200 and something dollars to just under $26,000 at the current conversion rate to U.S. dollars.
It doesn't seem like enough, does it?
Well, this is temporary.
Oh, that's
temporary harm. And we're talking about children. Of course, the specific degree of harm is going to vary from child to child. So it's kind of hard to really gauge that. And they don't give numbers here. Apparently, the handling of compensation payments related to lost earnings will begin only at the stage when the affected children turn 18. So they're putting off dealing with that. So the article is a little bit unclear about exactly what is being offered beyond the temporary. So we'll look for, I'm sure we'll see future articles on this because we've seen a series of articles over many months now. But it,
this is 78 children and young people who contracted the narcolepsy in Finland. And so over the coming years, we're going to probably watch their development.
Yes, and there may be some question as to whether the condition is temporary or permanent, but it seems to be at this point that they're certainly arguing that for many of these children that the condition has been determined to be permanent. And if, in fact, that's the case, you know, if you suddenly have your whole adult income-earning potential taken away from you or profoundly diminished at best, it's hard to put a number on that. But how much money, you know, does a reasonably intelligent person earn over their lifetime? You know, it could be
Right. Hundreds
of thousands or millions of dollars, depending on what sort of profession any given child was, you know, likely to pursue or capable of pursuing. So again, we'll look for updates on this and see where it plays out. But
okay. It
had, on the whole, a positive role, given that here in the U.S., for example, there tends to be a policy of complete denial that the adverse events even happen at all.
Right. So in Finland, they're a little bit sticking their neck out and taking responsibility. What bothers me is that when we know about these types of side effects for swine flu and other vaccines, that they don't put a halt to giving them out. But let's move on to the next issue. British pharmacy chain It announces a rollout of a new smart pill loaded with a microchip. And this is going to be up in the news a lot as technology evolves, as nanotechnology evolves, as microchips are going to be part of the environment, the scenery, everyday life. People are going to want microchips in them, just like people put them in their dogs to identify them. So they're going to have a lot of different functions. And now what's going to happen? A new pharmaceutical program that it's going on in the UK, it's a pharmacy chain called Lloyd's Pharmacy, partnering with the American technology firm Proteus Biomedical to bring to the British public this new product called Helios. It's a microchip. And what does this microchip do, Alan?
This is strange and silly and disturbing all at once to me. They're talking about a microchip that would be swallowed in a pill or potentially even in a placebo, whose purpose is, and I've got to read this word for word because it's just strange, to help remind patients to take their medication on time. Now, there's two parts here. Let's come back to the first part. But the second part actually makes a little bit of sense as far as it goes, to offer biofeedback such as body temperature, heart rate, and even sleeping patterns. In other words, the idea here is to provide information that, for example, might enable a doctor to see if the medication the patient's been given is doing what it's supposed to do.
Oh, I thought it was for the patient to get their own biofeedback so that they could calm down. I mean, there are programs, you know, that on your computer and whatnot, or temperature things that you put on your fingertips or your pulse, and then you do this biofeedback in order to reduce your stress and physically create this conscious awareness of whether you're high strung or not. And so you're saying it's for the doctors and not for the patients to get this feedback?
Well, for both, I think, but they're describing this as a system where the information goes out in such a way that the patient then goes to the web to see the results, and the doctor can also do that. And so it raises, enormous privacy issues,
mm-hmm.
even if we assume, and I think this is an enormous assumption, even if we assume that the chip is designed to do what it purports to be doing, and that only.
Right. You don't know what it's doing.
Well, we have no idea what else it might be doing, even if it is doing that. And assuming that it's completely benign in terms of its effect, not only on the individual, but ultimately in the environment, when you have millions of these chips assuming that the body eliminates the chip, and that's not a clear guarantee based on the information we have in this article. There's some question about whether or not the chip, you know, ends up being something that's permanently in your body somewhere or is eliminated.
That's a good question. I'm just imagining, you know, it going into the waste stream and other animals picking them up and possibly eating, ingesting them, and now the beep is going to go on the computer and it's going to be a dog or a cat.
Oh, that's right.
I have a vivid imagination.
You know, the doctor calls and say, we've determined from the feedback of your chip that you have turned into a raccoon. You know, it's sort of cute, the idea there. But the issues here, of course, are very serious ones.
Yes,
and we have documented several instances already where people in third world countries have been unwitting, unconsenting participants in vaccine experiments designed to control fertility, for example. Who knows what chips might be used in what situations to control what people. Now, they're using this. There's a hint to a potential underlying sinister agenda with the first part of what we talked about here to remind patients to take their medications. Now, I tell you, I'm nowhere near old age at this point. I mean, some might disagree, my children in particular, but I don't consider myself to be anywhere near old age, but I have occasional spaciness like most people who hit middle age and beyond. Although I've seen, you know, kids increasingly be spacey too, it makes me wonder if all of us are off or none of us are off. But in any case, you know, I can forget to do things. You know, I sometimes forget to take the supplements that I intend to take. But there are real simple things that people can do that don't require resorting to some sort of high-tech, internally ingested microchip to address the solution. And the World Health Organization, according to this article, suggests that, you know, gosh, at least I could find the way they phrase it here, that as many as half the people in the world don't take their medications correctly, putting themselves at risk. Now, that is a huge red flag to me. Oh, look, if we decide and promote that half the people in the world aren't taking their medication correctly, we can now microchip half the world.
Wow. So,
now,
so
not
this
only
is to get people to conform.
Well, my concern is that the promotion of this will make microchips the next cell phone in the sense that it'll become the thing that everybody should be doing and wants to do and wants to have. Oh, I'm getting in on this. You know, when cell phones were used by a small minority of people as they were initially when they were first available and came out, man, you were just totally hip and cool if you had a cell phone. And now, you know, everybody gets to be hip and cool and have a cell phone, regardless of the potential adverse effects in terms of people being distracted when they're driving, for example, or people having ill effects from the high recurring rate of exposure to the radio waves and so forth, and there being maybe less than complete, certainly in the early days of cell phones, less than complete information about if, when, how, and whether or not poses what level of risk of harm. We now know that the radiation from cell phone towers and cell phones can cause brain cancer, among other things. But, you know, profits are more important. In fact, we can profit twice, once from selling you the phone and once for and the second time for treating your ill effects from using the phone. But in any case, this is a huge, huge red flag to me. They're talking about, of course, a huge market if they can market this to half of the people on the planet. But they're also talking about a potential for an unconsenting, unwitting invasion of privacy towards
This is definitely a legal issue.
Well, it certainly raises legal issues, questions about privacy and so forth. But again, this is an issue we'll have to look at over time. While I hope I'm wrong, I would predict, based on what I'm seeing here, that chips will not only potentially be something that could be used covertly, where you wouldn't have any knowledge in advance, if ever, that you even had a chip inside you. People have talked about, for example, using vaccines as a way of distributing chips without even telling people they're getting chips.
Exactly. I'm sure they do it. I'm sure they do it somewhere.
But here, they're talking about making the chip, being very open about it. Oh, we have a chip. Don't you want one? Look at the wonderful things it can do for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can it do wonderful things? Maybe. Do you really need it to cover these things, to do these things? Well, not to remind you to take your medication. If you can't use any of the many different simple, low-tech available means of ensuring that you take your proper medication at the proper time and so forth,
people don't want to have to think about it. People want somebody or something to do it. Like for my banking, I don't like to write out a check every month. I like it to be automated. So I want everything in my life to be automated. I want somebody to check my pulse and know my body temperature is right.
But nobody can swallow your pill for you. And if you have, they make the little plastic containers for where you have a little compartment for each day of the week. Once a week, you can just fill all the little boxes. And if the Monday box is empty, then you took your Monday medication. If it's not, then you take your medication. I mean, it's that simple.
Yeah, but I don't want to have a box to look at every single day. I just want to take a microchip and let it happen.
Well, the chip won't take your medication for you. Still will have to go to the web to see if you took your medication. Why have to go to the web? That's an extra step. It's easier to look at the box and see if it's empty. But that's just one.
You're too smart for me.
Maybe so.
Okay. Well, you know what? I want to interject here that Dr. Waqar Ali Khan, one of our Homeopathy World Community members, posted on our site, will smartphones become our personal physician's assistant? So there is this technology. It's maybe one step away from the swallow the pill idea of nanotechnology. This one is a smartphone technology that will also do all of your body functions, and it will report it directly to the hospital or the doctor. You just touch your screen on your smartphone, and it will send your blood pressure, your pulse, your insulin level, and everything else.
Well, I like that idea because the person is making a conscious choice about whether or not to relay the information. Of course, they'll need a chip to remind them to do that, right?
I forgot to tell you how it works, Alan.
Okay.
This is they're detecting human DNA. In this innovation, they detect our protein DNA. And so no matter, let's say you're in an airport, at an airport scanner or whatever. I mean, if you're touching your screen and it's reading your protein DNA, what if you touch somebody else's screen and they start reading your DNA?
Well, I'm skeptical of more than one thing in that suggestion. The general idea of, do I want to send information, as long as I'm sending the information that I want to send and nothing else is being sent, as long as I'm only doing what I want to do and nothing else is being done to me covertly, I'm all for, informed choice in that kind of situation. But if you're sending more information than you want to,
right.
Of course, the point you're raising is how reliable is it and how easy is it to confuse
to capture.
It or whatever.
Yes,
I mean, I think
it's easy to capture this information to send it somewhere that you don't want it sent and that kind of thing. So, I don't know where the limits are. I don't know where the boundaries are between what we are giving permission for and what we, have the ability to block happening to us.
Well, there's a mentality in our society and culture which says plow forward without thoroughly investigating, and if and as the problems come up, deal with them then. The problem with that mentality is, of course, if you are more careful in your approach, you can anticipate and avoid or prevent serious problems from happening in the first place, which when it comes to people's health is almost always the preferred approach. but also there is such persistent and deliberate efforts to cover up problems in this culture, to pretend they don't exist or to downplay or minimize them, that the idea of just plowing ahead forward and then as the problems arise, you deal with them, it just doesn't make sense from that point of view either. So it's a serious problem the way that medical.
You know, I think we could do a whole show on microchips and nanotechnology. Vic is in the chat today. He has put forth some of his own ideas. I don't know whether he wants to call in and talk with us, or I can just read this out. He says, how far will the people go with this technology? How will they remind us if we don't want to take the pills? Will they call the police? Will they take us to a camp? Will they remotely send us pain? Oh, my goodness gracious. Or the chip, would it cause cancer or neural damages? That I don't know. And
these are all, of course, critical questions. And the idea of, is the chip going to do something that we weren't told it might do? I mean,
little goodie is I had a friend that she actually took a pill and it had a camera in it. So because she was having trouble with her digestive tract. And this camera, it was like a 24-hour pill. She swallowed the pill, and it took constant pictures throughout her system and then reported what was going on internally. How do we know that some pill doesn't have something of that nature?
Well, this is the problem. You know, there's one more extreme view on vaccines, but there certainly is some evidence to support this. There was a French-Canadian medical doctor who wrote a whole book called Medical Mafia, and one of the assertions in that book is that the pharmaceutical industry is using vaccines deliberately to create chronic disease in the population so that they then have a market for more pharmaceutical products. So not in effect, they're getting paid both to create and to treat chronic disease.
Well, if you can get it both ways, I mean, that's a good way to make your income.
Well, from a pure cold calculating point of view, it sounds like a way of maximizing your profits. You know, of course, the questions arise, would anybody really knowingly do that? And if so, you know, how can they actually get away with it and so forth and so on? But the issue here is that when somebody is putting something microscopic in your body, they can tell you what it is, but you have nothing but faith to rely on, most of us anyway, with regard to, is that really what they're putting in? Is that really what it does? Is that really all it does? There could be deliberate or completely unintended chronic disease consequences from swallowing a piece of technology. Is it toxic? Might it cause cancer? Might it cause damage or harm in ways that were unanticipated or unintended? Might it even be deliberately intended to create conditions chronic conditions that can then be treated to boost profits in the pharmaceutical industry? Now, you know, for those not as familiar with the downside of the pharmaceutical industry, let me just mention briefly, this is an industry that routinely engages in criminal behavior as evidenced by criminal fines that the industry receives on a regular basis. The industry receives billions of dollars in criminal and civil fines every year.
This is their modus operandi.
Yeah, so this is not just some sort of wild conspiracy theory, you know, unsupported information, oh my gosh, pharmaceuticals are all bad or whatever. And I'm sure that I would personally believe anyway, that the majority of pharmaceutical employees are people of integrity who truly and genuinely want to help people. But the reality is it only takes a few people in key positions in government or industry to completely skew or subvert the larger wishes and intentions of the majority of people who are subject to the orders and direction of the few. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest that in industry and government that that's exactly how it works. But let's move on here.
Yeah, here's another one that's very similar in a way. Novartis, this is a video that you can watch because there's probably a place where it's actually printed, but you can listen to this gentleman talking from Vaccine Liberation Army, posted January 18, 2012, about 2 million rabies vaccines that are put into fish oil capsules or baits, they're called, and they're dropped over the state of Texas. And this is done by Novartis, another pharma company which does great stuff for us, and so we really have no idea what's happening once those little capsules of bait drop over the state.
The Texas has done this in the past, and they are doing it again now. Over a course of about a month, they're going to drop 1.8 million of these vaccine bait doses. They're, as you said, in fish oil and covered with fish meal crumbles.
Ooh, yum, yum. And fish oil is so good for you.
Yeah. You know, in 2009, Texas had reported 839 cases of rabies, and so the response is to drop 2 million vaccine bait doses, as they're called, with live rabies vaccine. Now, the Department of Health in Texas has some cautions here. They say it won't hurt pets or livestock if they consume one of these.
Right.
But they're dropping 1.8 million. So what if your dog, you know, is running loose on your ranch or farm or home?
Right.
And
I want to crumble.
Do more of these.
I want to eat some of those. You know, it's like coffee cake crumble. I want one. So.
Yeah, fish crumbles doesn't do it for me, but I imagine it will for a wide range of animals. And that,
right,
of course, the ones that aren't eaten, of course, are going to get into the environment. And this raises, you know, a long list of questions. You're saying if you come in contact with the inside of one of these, wash your hands with soap and water immediately. If you're immunocompromised, report this contact immediately to your family doctor or your doctor. I mean, they're just sort of throwing this all over Texas. I mean, over, I'm sure it's targeted areas, but, you know, why drop from the air over large areas of the state? And then
it's a form of warfare. You know, you think of bombing, you think of dropping, well, either you could be dropping cheese, you know, to the population that's poverty stricken and in need, or you can drop fish bait, or you can drop bombs.
Well, they claim that they've had success with this in the past in terms of it reducing, reported rabies cases. I don't know what to make of those reports specifically. I don't really have information confirming or denying that. But the idea of dropping live virus just sort of randomly, I mean, sure, there's a targeted area, but otherwise sort of randomly dropping, you know, a couple of million vaccines, in effect, and what impact that may have on the intended target animals, but the unintended animals that will also be consuming these, or the fact that these are just going to be otherwise ultimately dissolving and going into the environment in a broad way. This is a live vaccine that they're using.
Right.
Presumably an attenuated virus, but has serious questions.
Yes, let's move on. Polio vaccines are now the number one cause of polio paralysis. Posted an activist post in January 18, 2012. And what do you want to tell us about this one?
Well, this is an article that's talking about India and the Polio Global Eradication Initiative, PGEI, is now claiming success, that they've eradicated polio. This article is raising some very serious questions about that claim, and in particular, there have been, in recent years in India, documented cases of wild polio, but also documented instances every year of vaccine-associated polio paralysis, VAPP for short. I think they said of an estimated 100 to 180 Indian children are diagnosed with this VAPP, vaccine-associated polio paralysis. In other words, kids who get polio paralysis from the vaccine. And they're saying it's a bit disingenuous here or very misleading to say polio is eradicated when you have cases of paralytic polio from the vaccine. I mean, isn't that something that when you're talking about whether or not polio has been eradicated, should you not also be talking about the fact that nonetheless there is polio paralysis that continues happening every year?
Maybe they misspoke.
You're too kind.
Well, I mean, honestly, I mean, the natural wild polio virus isn't giving it to the children. It's the vaccine. So the wild one, it says that this particular form of paralysis is indistinguishable from that caused by the wild polio virus. I wonder what that means.
Well, if it's indistinguishable, that means we're not really sure. Maybe they're attributing wild poliovirus to the vaccine, saying, well, it can't be wild because we've gotten rid of that. There's this interesting mentality in the pro-vaccine arena where you assume, for example, that the vaccines are safe, and therefore when somebody has a reaction to a vaccine, the doctors aren't looking in an unscientific investigative or medical investigative way to determine whether or not the symptom or condition is related to the vaccine. They presume in the absence of any scientific evidence that vaccines are safe, therefore it didn't cause this condition and it was just a random chance in terms of the timing that you had a vaccine one day and a week later you have this debilitating condition set in that we don't know what caused it, but it wasn't a vaccine because vaccines don't do that. It's this, you know, circular reasoning that really is just not logical, and it looks like that goes on in different aspects of the vaccine issue, including situations like this where they're making the declaration that polio has now been eradicated.
Right. So it's possible, you know, the vaccine actually didn't work, and they contracted polio even if they were vaccinated. That could possibly happen. So, you know, somebody's called in, but I have no idea who it is. If they're on the chat, they could always give us tell us that you have called in. And I tried to get them to answer my call, but nope, nobody did. Do we want to do something else for the last 10 minutes? We've got the next thing we have is swine flu. Go ahead. What?
Let's move over to the issue that talks about a very serious ethical question about whether or not participation in vaccine clinical trials should be mandated.
Wow.
And I can't even believe the question is being raised.
So that is incredible.
Yes.
Sure.
This comes from a website called Virtual Mentor. Looks like it's associated with the AMA, American Medical Association. And this is a very pro-vaccine article, perhaps that goes without saying just by the title, Should Participation in Vaccine Clinical Trials Be Mandated? The article gives, in the opening, a brief nod to all of the primary mainstream assumptions that are about vaccines, that they are wonderful, the most effective tool ever invented, saved millions of people, and so forth. Assertions that we have credible and well-documented information to directly refute. So I don't know at this stage in my many years of exploring the vaccine issue really any other way to respond to that those opening assertions as those have to be deliberate lies because there is clear, readily available information from authoritative sources that show, for example, that majority of vaccine of infectious disease decline preceded the vaccines, an average of about 95% by some counts. So to say that, you know, vaccines are the most effective tool ever invented and have saved millions of lives and so forth is just not supported by the mainstream medical evidence. But in any case, the article goes on to discuss some of the difficulties in doing clinical trials. How do you get healthy volunteers? It seems that there's been a decline in people volunteering. Gee, I wonder why.
So in other words, if they can't just use mice or monkeys or dogs or pigs, they're going to start using people.
Well, ultimately, if you're going to test a drug or product or a vaccine, in this case, you know, you have to do trials on people. There are supposedly strict protocols that require you to start with animals and reach a certain level of proven effectiveness and safety before you can go to human beings. But there's no way to know what's going to happen in human beings ultimately until you start using them. But they go so far as to point out things such as, well, many countries, of course, including the U.S., mandate vaccines under this theory of the minimal risk of harm from the vaccine is far outweighed by the benefit from vaccines. We have many countries in the world today, if not the U.S. at this point in time, that mandate service in the military. You know, that's a risk of injury or death for the benefit of the whole. This concept, and really the underlying concept and controversial point, is the idea and the question of to what extent should an individual be required to engage in risks of bodily harm for the benefit of society as a whole? And there's two fundamental aspects to that I want to mention. The first one is that the question left at that level misses a profound underlying reality about corruption, conflict of interest, and deceit and deception that pervades the pharmaceutical industry and state and federal health agencies. And I don't mean any disrespect to the many, I'm sure, honorable employees in government and industry who are people of integrity. It's not by any means a comment I make as a smear to those industry employees collectively and government agency employees collectively. I think many of those people are people of integrity who are doing the right thing or trying to do the right thing. But again, the evidence is just overwhelming that there is nonetheless deceit, deception, corruption, conflicts of interest that profoundly skew the output and result of the industry and government efforts to protect the interests of the people. And so it's not just as simple as, and let me give a real clear example. We hear over and over again from the CDC and state officials and government officials in the pharmaceutical industry that vaccine benefits far outweigh any detriment. Yet the CDC and FDA have both told us in the past that 90 to 99% of adverse events are not even reported. Former FDA Commissioner David Kessler has even gone so far as to say fewer than 1% of adverse drug events are reported. We do not have data available from which to make a cost-benefit assessment of vaccines or other drugs for that matter. The data is simply not there. So even if we assume that vaccines are completely effective, a whole separate question, we don't know if there's a net benefit or not. Now, as to are they effective, we have example. I'll just give a quick example that I've talked about in the past. The Cochrane Institute, a nonprofit think tank with researchers, have done several reviews of the vaccine flu literature, and one of the more recent ones they did just a little over a year ago concluded that there's little, if any, evidence to show that flu vaccines actually work, but there's lots of evidence of widespread manipulation of the conclusions. So that just sort of underscores the reality that we are now at a place in time where other people have spoken out and said similar things, that we cannot rely on the medical literature to provide us with objective scientific results driven by money. So we can't even address the question of cost-benefit because we can't trust the studies and because there's not data on the adverse events to enable us to make the comparison.
We have about 3 minutes left, so either you want to just give them some information to summarize, and we will continue with the news next Thursday at noon.
Yes, let's do that. So thanks for prompting me to sort of reel myself in on this. So what I want to say about this idea of forced participation in clinical trials, we do not live in a time where there is an environment of integrity and trust and reliability on the people involved, the motives and the conflicts of interest and the evidence suggests that even if it were otherwise appropriate, it's just not a safe thing to do. Now, on a more just sort of fundamental freedom level, to require people to get vaccines the way we do raises questions about the integrity of our Republican form of government. And when I say Republican, I don't mean versus Democrat. I mean we are a democratic republic. Our republic, it is a valid question in terms of definitions as to whether or not we even are a republic when we mandate vaccines. When you take it the next step and you're going to mandate that people participate in clinical trials, we are moving in the direction of a police state and away from the republic. It just violates fundamental freedom of choice. There's no more fundamental aspect of freedom than bodily integrity and personal freedom with regard to your own body. So needless to say, I adamantly oppose even mandatory vaccines at all in the first place, let alone going the next step and mandating participation in vaccine clinical trials. It's just absurd to even raise the question.
Okay. On that high note, we're going to conclude today's show. And in a couple of minutes, we're going to have Christina Chambreau, Doctor of Veterinary Medicine, talking to us about the early warning signs when our pets are getting ill. And she has been doing a series of tutorials over the Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio. Again, let's remind the people that they can check out your website, pandemicresponseproject.com.
Yes.
And get more news and also find out about your ebook on waivers and exemptions for vaccinations. And we have a Monday night show with Grant Bentley on facial analysis on Wednesday morning at 11 a.m. We have Dr. Otto talking to us about heart health, keeping our heart healthy, diabetes, exercise. Next time, I think we might be talking about the food groups, eating for your blood type. So we have tons of awesome informative and educational free programming. I'm going to turn it over to the exit, and we'll see you next Thursday.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.